You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. So nice to have you with us. And yes, you guessed it, I'm at it again. My history books are stacked on my desk, and one that I highly recommend this year is a new book by an author that we had on back a few years ago, Pulitzer Prize finalist James Scott, well-known historian. His new book, Empire of Ashes, Truman, Hirohito, and The Descent into Total War. And Jim and I had a chance to talk a little bit before broadcast, and just going back and forth on how people feel that we're headed into a situation or a period of unimaginable challenges. Well, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of this segment, you'll understand that this country has been through segments of challenges far more heady in this particular period of World War II, where Franklin Roosevelt, who was beloved by the American people, had died. And a simple Midwestern guy by the name of Harry Truman had to step in as president and make some major decisions. One of those decisions was to use nuclear weapons. So, as they say, sit back, relax, and for the next half hour, we'll be talking with historian James Scott. Jim, nice to have you with us again.
Al, thanks so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
This this book, I just can't put down. People know I say it all the time, so I don't want to sound like going over and over and over the same thing. But history for me is always eye-opening, and it doesn't matter how many times I read about different periods. But as I was reading your book, Empire of Ashes, I'm putting myself into position or trying to put myself in the shoes of a Harry Truman, not a polished politician. I think even he at the time would have admitted that he felt many times uncomfortable in the role as a politician, let alone vice president, and then ultimately being thrown into the into the top dog seat, being president upon Franklin Roosevelt's death. But not only that, again, you and I discussed this. We were in the midst of a war with Japan and Germany. We had to deal with allies. We had to deal with the American troops going over there, families losing loved ones. So much combination of emotions and major challenges. You talk about challenges, boy, I would not want to have been in Harry Truman's shoes. But going back to all of that, let me ask you right up front. Empire of Ashes, you focus on his administration and how this guy, the spotlight's on Harry Truman. What was it, for the same reasons that this man had to be thrown into the limelight, a position he was never really comfortable with, to make some of the most major decisions in U.S. history?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things that fascinates me about Truman is, as you know, he inherits this huge responsibility, and nobody is more aware of just how daunting of a task is facing him than Truman is. In fact, one of my favorite anecdotes is, every time a reporter asks him, how do you feel? He's like, he's basically telling the truth. He's like, I'm overwhelmed. I hope I can live up to it. And finally, Jimmy Burns, who was ultimately going to be his Secretary of State and was a close confidant of FDR, finally pulls him aside and says to him, he says, you can't keep saying this to the press. You gotta project strength and safety and assurances to the American public, because no matter how you feel, the world needs to know that everything's going to be okay and that they're in capable hands. And I love that anecdote because it really does capture just how overwhelming of a moment this was for Harry Truman as an individual. He's been vice president for 82 days. He's this plain-spoken Missouri former farmer, no college education, who sort of just in a lot of ways sort of rises and in some cases even fails his way up. He's a failed businessman in a number of cases to becoming president. And, of course, at this moment, too, it's this huge question mark for the American public because FDR has been president for over 4,000 days. I mean, if you're in middle school at this time, you've never known life without FDR at the helm. And so all these huge uncertainties sort of are there for Truman, for the American public. And, of course, this is his most consequential moment because the war is still going on. We're getting ready, you know, where Okinawa, the battle for Okinawa is taking place, the most horrific battle of the Pacific, contemplation of an invasion of the Japanese homeland. And there's just so much going on at this pivotal moment. And I just think, for me, you know, that just made such a great starting point for this book, which is, let's begin the day Truman has to take over, the day FDR dies, and let's track that moment until August 15th. When Japan surrenders, that 125 days, that just tiny, tight window, what was it like to be Harry Truman and to be in America at that point?
I'm so glad you said it the way you did it, that very small, short window, because you're exactly right. Yeah. He steps in, he's uncomfortable. You know, as you said, thank God he had, you know, he had surrounded himself with some people who were able to give him some tips and, you know, help him along. But there's so many facets to the book that are fascinating, that being one of the pinnacle ones. And then as I start to delve into the book, you think, oh, you know, the Japanese had, you know, had the upper hand. Well, maybe initially, you know, those who remember, we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. We were not at war with Japan at the time. But mm-hmm. then you describe very clearly and you know, precisely what was going on in Japan. Cities were devastated. They didn't have the natural resources. People were starving. They were losing loved ones. You know, the emperor and you know, his folks, the military especially, were putting unprecedented pressure and requirements on people. And I'm thinking, why didn't the people themselves rise up? So when people talk about you know, tyranny, and when they talk about somebody who does not care for anything but power, then you should look at, you know, World War II Japan. These people, their lives were just, there was no life. Waking up every morning to bombings and not knowing if you're going to live from day to day. You know, so Harry Truman, I mean, going back to what you said, now Truman had to take all of this into account, the lives of, you know, obviously the Japanese civilians who probably didn't want to be at war, especially at that point. But not only that, American servicemen, huge, as you talked about, Okinawa and many of the other battles that we fought with them, the amount of life that was lost. And you know, this guy not being a polished, as you said, not educated, not highly educated by any stretch of the imagination, not a polished speaker, rises to the occasion. I guess in summing it up, and I'm going to let you take it from there, I feel triumph. At the end of the book, the light shines on Harry Truman, and you see triumph like nobody would ever have imagined when he took over. Does that sound accurate?
Totally. And you know what Truman is? He's just a good person, and he's very much an American everyman. And by that, I mean he's just, you know, he speaks volumes to sort of that quintessential American story of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. I mean, he didn't go to college, not because he wasn't bright, but because his family didn't have the resources. You know, he'd spent over a decade working on his family's farm as a young adult, where, you know, his days began before sunrise, where his jobs included having to castrate hogs. I mean, this was hard, hard labor. And what it did is it shaped him, and it made him a tenacious, hardworking, driven individual, so that when he does take over as president, one of the things he has is this tremendous work ethic. So he gets up every morning at the crack of dawn. He studies. He recognizes the weaknesses in his own education, because FDR made no effort to tutor him about what he would inherit in the chance that he died. So Truman has to study all that, and so so beyond just bringing that sort of that great work ethic and tireless study to it, he is a good barometer for people, you know, and a good moral conscience in a lot of ways. I mean, he's a very much a family man. You know, he's got a daughter. He loves his wife. I mean, the White House staff jokingly referred them as the Three Musketeers. They hung out all the time together. You know, he had seen the horror of war firsthand. He'd been an artilleryman during World War I. He'd seen the trenches. He'd seen what happened when shells exploded around him and disinterred bodies. He knew what American troops were facing in places like Okinawa. He also was sympathetic to the Japanese. I mean, after the Nagasaki bombing, he puts out an order that there are going to be no more atomic bombs without his express approval, because he doesn't want unnecessary civilian deaths. I mean, he is mindful of what these weapons are doing to the Japanese public, and so he's a, like I said, he's a good guy, is what it really comes down to in a lot of ways. And I think he was the right guy at that moment. And you know, you couldn't juxtapose two completely different individuals than Harry Truman and FDR. I mean, FDR was this, he represented American aristocracy. He was a product of the elite schools, of family wealth, you know, vacations in Europe at that time period, beachfront, you know, summers. He was a consummate politician. And, you know, Truman was just the complete opposite of all of that. But in the end, he was the right person at the right time.
Yeah, what a contrast. And it really, you know, you clearly carved out each person's personality perfectly. And I want to pick it up from there. But let me just take a quick pause to remind our listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is Pulitzer Prize finalist and historian James Scott. The new book is Empire of Ashes. And Jim, that description, I'm thinking, you know, with all the challenges that this country is once again going through right now, and how people feel diverse, you know, they just feel that there's a small group that believes the way they do, and across the street somebody feels differently. A lot of divisiveness going on, and I'm thinking Harry Truman would probably be the perfect guy today as well. Not a polished politician, no major background in terms of affluency family heritage. Worked his butt off. He's an everyday American, and thrown into an environment that you clearly point out that he was not totally comfortable with. But the part that, and I'm glad you brought that up, the part that really stuck out for me as well, is that this guy was not a warmonger. This guy, and he'd been at war. He had seen death. He had seen what it was like to fight the enemy. But at the end of the day, there's a certain level of humanitarianism within Harry Truman that I think lacks in so many political leaders across the globe. And you beautifully carved that out in that. But that wasn't always a plus for him. I mean, I think it resonated with many Americans. But you get those political elites in Washington, especially at that time, you know, at war, we want to win. You know, the United States is going to be the greatest power on the face of the earth. And we ended up being just that. A lot of people would have just said, you know, I'm not going to, especially the military. And many times, and you mentioned this, all the generals, all the military leaders that came in for close, briefings and meetings. And yet Harry Truman, held his own, stayed calm, and at the end of the day made the decisions that I think were, I don't know, and this is what I want to ask you. I don't know if we had a choice, and I want to get your sense on this. Mm-hmm. Did Truman have a choice? I mean, could we have continued the battle without nuclear weapons? But what would that have been like?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that's the of course Truman has a choice, you know. And there have been some historians who tried to say that, you know, there was so much momentum built up behind the Manhattan Project that the bomb was going to be dropped regardless. And certainly there was tremendous momentum built up. I mean, the United States has spent $2 billion in 1940s money on this project. We'd built top secret cities across the United States. I mean, we had thrown in an unprecedented level of resource at this project. But at the same time, however, he is commander in chief, and he very much could I've said, there's no way we're going to do it. In fact, he does. After the second bombing, he puts his foot down and says, there's not going to be any more of this. The bigger question, however, is why would he have done that? And that's what I think people lose sight of today. And that last year of the war it really reaches just a crescendo of violence. And what happens is that the Japanese have realized that as the Americans have sort of shrunk their empire down to just the home islands, that outright victory is never going to be an option for them. And so what they really are intent to do is to grind down the Americans through a war of attrition with the hopes that they can avoid unconditional surrender and that they can have some sort of negotiated end to the war that will keep their governing structure in place and prevent war crimes trials and an occupation. And so what they do is they change their battlefield tactics, and they turn each of these islands into just really just horror stories for American troops. I mean, you take Iwo Jima, for example, and, you know, it's an 8-square-mile island, and you know, it takes 32 days for the Americans to take this island. That's really just minuscule in size. And I'll tell you, I've been to Iwo Jima, and when you stand on top of Mount Suribachi, where the famous flag raising was, and you look out, you can see from one end of the island to the next. I've walked from the airfield to the top of Suribachi in an hour and a half. That's all the way across the island. You had 50,000 casualties to take that tiny island, 20,000 Japanese dead, 7,000 Americans dead, 20,000 Americans wounded, just for 8 miles. Now, you take that and spread that out across the island of Kyushu, which is, you know, 100 times larger than that, or the island of Honshu, 1,000 times larger than
that.
Americans were facing just one hellacious end to this war. And Truman understood that. I mean, the projections in July of 1945 at the Pentagon were that invasion of the home islands, America was looking at 1.7 to 4 million casualties. Japanese were looking at 5 to 10 million. I mean, these were real numbers in Truman's eyes. You know, he'd seen war up close. Okinawa was going on then, which, of course, is the bloodiest battle of the Pacific War, over 100,000 civilians killed, 25,000 combat fatigue cases for the Americans alone. I mean, that's the horror of how bad that battle was. That the War Department's getting letters from parents, you know, whose children are fighting in this. Editorials in the New York Times and others are saying, hey, if Okinawa is this bad, what is the invasion of the home islands going to be like? So this was a real public debate that was happening in 1945.
Yeah.
Everybody understood what it was going to be like when these two titanic armies collided with one another. And it's important that people remember is that people like to say, well, Japan was defeated at this point. Well, yes and no. Yeah, their navy was largely destroyed and their air force is being converted to kamikazes. But they still had 5 million troops under arms. I mean, that's a huge army.
Right.
And they were moving those troops down to the island of Kyushu, which was going to be the next invasion point for the Americans, to the point where we were facing a one-to-one ratio of Americans versus Japanese, and that is not a recipe for an easy victory by any stretch. So the Americans, it was going to be a bloodbath. There's no doubt about it.
Right, and it's funny because you and I remember vividly. I was just old enough for the draft. In fact, did sign up for the draft. Thank God, didn't have to go to Vietnam. But the debate in this country, and it was vehement, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, stop it. What are we doing there? Servicemen, families watching their loved ones come back in body bags. And I'm thinking, that was bad. That was really bad. And that was something vividly that I remember. World War II, this particular period with Japan, as you said, the amount of American loss was phenomenal. And I'm trying to put myself in the position of family members, the only child, the only son going off to battle in a foreign land, 18 years old, 17 years old, 19 years old, whatever it may be, didn't matter.
Yeah.
There was a lot of life was on the line. And I go back to the right man at the right time, Harry Truman, knowing that we had to do something, we had to curtail this as quickly as possible. As I look at it now, as I look back on the book, I don't think he had a choice, but at the same token, he wasn't a warmonger. He didn't say, let's hit him again, let's really pulverize. He drew the line. Two was enough. We've destroyed two huge cities. We've wiped out so many lives. Let's see what happens. And thank God the Japanese came to their senses and decided that, you know, this will be the end of a nation if we don't stop now. So I guess what I'm asking you is, as you were, you know, doing the research for the book, especially in Truman and his personality, would you agree that almost anybody else would not have gone the path that he went? I'm talking about in terms of putting the brakes on and saying, okay, enough is enough. I have a heart as well.
Yeah, you know, the challenge, of course, at that time was that we simply didn't have another bomb ready. Had we had a stockpile, you know, it could have been a different scenario. But what happened is, and I'll tell you, one of the people don't realize that the smartest thing that the United States ever did was they dropped two of them back to back. Because what had happened is Japan at that point was being controlled by six individuals, which is their war cabinet. And it was colloquially called the Big Six. But it was divided, and the militarists, who were largely in control and had the most power and the most dominant force there, really were adamant that you know, the war needed to continue, and that the climax of the war would take place on the Japanese Hanama Islands. And Hirohito was very alarmed about that, and he was very worried that it was going to lead to massive civilian deaths. And of course, people forget that atomic energy at that point, even though it was a huge top secret program in the United States, in the physics community, the energy that lay at the heart of an atom was very widely known. I mean, it was atomic physics was like the AI of its day.
Right.
So Germany had a program. Japan had been trying to build a bomb. Neither of those countries got anywhere near the level that the United States did. So, but when the bomb goes off inside Japan, some of the militarists said, well, you know, we know how expensive this is and how difficult this is. There's no way that the Americans have more than one of these bombs, and our regime is still intact, and we should continue fighting. And what happened then is the second bomb's dropped 75 hours later. And at that point, that it really crystallizes for Hirohito that the Americans, if they can drop two of these things in 75 hours, they may have 20, they may have 200 of them. We simply don't know, but they've obviously got a lot of them. And therefore, they may never invade. They may just sit offshore and just drop one after the other every few days until there's nothing left. And what's fascinating is that almost didn't happen that way, because the second bomb actually wasn't scheduled to be dropped until August 11th, which is almost a week later.
Right.
But it was the wisdom of Leslie Groves and Curtis LeMay, who basically said, no, we've got to move heaven and earth. We've got to get the second bomb on Japan as quickly as we can, which required a tremendous effort by the Manhattan Project scientists that were out in the Pacific to assemble the second bomb, to get the crew ready, and to really get that bomb in motion to make that happen. But it ended up being the smartest move possible, because that initiative may very well have been lost had those bombs not been dropped back to back. So people always ask me about, you know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and I say Nagasaki is the turning point of the war.
Right.
It's it's amazing. You go to Nagasaki today, and it gets a fraction of the tourists that Hiroshima gets. People, when they think of the anniversaries every year, very few people talk about Nagasaki, but Nagasaki is the turning point of the war.
Yeah,
what convinces Japan that the game is over.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you touched upon, there were two things again. There was the, you know, Leslie Groves and LeMay, and these were at that time during World War II the top military leaders who were also the confidants of President Truman. The other side of the coin was these men were not scientists. This was new technology, as you said. So now you have Oppenheimer and a whole host of the you know, physicists and the greatest scientific minds of that time coming together, working on these secret projects. And the thing that really amazed me is after they finally get this thing under control, where they can realize that we can put this into a bomb and we can do major damage. And this comes out in the book, that now they're starting to scratch their heads, the scientific community I'm talking about, and they're having second thoughts. And now they're going back to the politicians and saying, on second thought, in spite of all the money, in spite of all the effort and the success we've had, I think we better think twice about this. And I'm thinking, oh, no. Not only was Truman thrown into this position, but he had to ramp up real quick. Initially had the scientific community and the military kind of in sync. And now all of a sudden, within that, you know, that grouping, there's different viewpoints. And I'm thinking, you couldn't ask. I guess what I'm trying to say, Jim, I want to get your sense on this, is I would not want that job for anything.
No.
Right?
No, and I think you've got, not only do you have Truman, who's, you know, got these scientists that are starting to question, you know, the morality of it, you've got this sort of breakdown inside the State Department over whether America should walk away from unconditional surrender, which of course had been sort of the mantra throughout World War II, that we were going to, you know, sort of remake Japanese society and eliminate the militarists. And so you do have the sense after Germany surrenders of people saying, you know what, maybe we don't have to continue to fight Japan, or maybe we can just get a conditional surrender or whatnot. And so Truman's having to negotiate the politics of war termination, the morality of the bomb, with some of the scientists. I mean, and all of these are very difficult challenges and questions that get at the heart of humanity in a lot of ways. And that's what I'm saying, like, Truman kind of has this moral conscience of America at that moment, and that he's got to navigate these difficult, thorny questions and come up with the best solution. And I think in Truman's eyes, you know, I think that the atomic bomb really, in a lot of ways, becomes sort of like ripping a Band-Aid off. And I use that expression not to trivialize it, but to say that when you're taking a Band-Aid off, if you rip it off really fast, it hurts right away really bad, right? Take some hair off and skin and all that. But it's over, and the pain goes away.
Right.
If you slowly pull it off,
ouch,
it's going to hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt and hurt. And I think he viewed the war in that same capacity, which is we've got to use whatever it takes to hurry up and end this, because this bloodletting is only going to get worse and worse and worse. And what people forget is that it's not just the United States and Japan, is that 20 million people are going to die in China. You know, right now in Japan, I mean, in Asia at large, you're losing anywhere from 250 to 500,000 people every single month from the war in China, from disease, from famine, from all the byproducts of war. So the longer this drags on, you're not only going to see, you know, huge American casualties, huge Japanese casualties, you're going to continue to see all these other deaths across all of Asia. So it's really just like the world has to end this conflict in order to sort of, you know, stabilize food markets, you know, bring about an end to disease, stop the deaths.
Yeah.
So it's really it's a much more complex equation, I think, than people realize at the end of the war.
I'm so glad you brought it. You said it in that way. It was multifaceted. It was extremely complex. And we've only got a couple of moments left, but I gotta, you know, what I guess what I'm trying to say, and I'll let you wrap it up real quick, is the fact that you know, this country had major decisions to make. This was a war. This was a world war. Millions of lives, not only of Americans but worldwide. And you know, a handful of men in Washington, D.C. had to make a decision. And there was divisiveness even then. So anybody that says there wasn't, all you have to do is read Empire of Ashes and you'll find out. But at the end, you know, Harry Truman, you know, rises, as they say, rises to the occasion and takes what I think, and you said it yourself, there would have been millions of more lives lost. Probably the only solution he saw at that point. I mean, I'll let you take it from there before we close out.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think this was, you know, in the words of Henry Stenson, who was his war secretary, this was the least horrible alternative to how to end the war. And that's the reality of it. I mean, there are no good ways to end this war. You're going to have to go through a period of extreme violence one way or the other in order to come out into a peaceful post-war environment. And so the question was, what is the least horrible alternative? And I think they viewed that as being the atomic bomb, that yes, it's awful, it's going to obliterate a city, but if it accomplishes what we hope it's going to accomplish, i.e. bring about an end to the war, and very quickly, then it's a win for not just for the United States, but also for Japan. It's going to spare the Japanese the loss of so many of their civilian lives. It's going to spare the Americans, you know, this horrible fight of having to come ashore and having to shoot children and grandparents because the Japanese have enlisted them into this conflict. It's going to be the best way to end it.
Yeah, it's never, war is never good. War never makes people feel good. I mean, sure, there's always warmongers, but you know, it's death, it's suffering for masses of people, and this certainly was it. And I can't say enough about Empire of Ashes. And you know, James Scott's been with us in the past, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. The book really shows a side to the United States that we were not warmongers. We took what we thought was the least likely option in destroying people, and it took leadership. And in spite of the divisiveness, and in spite of various opinions, we came together as a nation, and we can still do that even to this very day. Jim, we only got a few moments left. People want to reach out to you directly. How might they do that?
Yeah, I've got a website, jamesmscott.com. Again, jamesmscott.com. You can go on there, learn all about this book, my others. There's also email and my links to my social media, my Facebook, Twitter, and all that are on there as well. So I would encourage people to go to www.jamesmscott.com.
And again, Empire of Ashes is the new book, widely available and a great read. For the public eye, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And if you have any questions about the broadcast, we always welcome that. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can email me directly. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. And by all means, peruse our website, and you'll find a host of wonderful shows that we do here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Much like, and I'm not tooting my own horn, I just, you know, James Scott made the segment this evening so wonderful because people are passionate about what they do, and that's what we love to bring to you, our audience. So again, I want to thank my guest, James Scott, and for the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.